yesterday I started talking about large extra dimensions. And the idea here is that you have the standard model confined at some four-dimensional subspace of a larger higher dimensional space. And in the higher dimensional space, gravity propagates everywhere. And if the size of the extra dimensions are somewhat large compared to the fundamental Planck scale, what we get is essentially the gravitational force that we see at long distances is different from the fundamental Planck scale of the full theory at microscopic distances due to a volume dilution. So this is the idea of large extra dimensions. The thing I got to at the end of the last class was KK expansions of the graviton field. So remember that we had, because this is periodic, we could write our because our modes are periodic, you can expand in the extra dimensional component in terms of exponentials. And here this n dot w just means for each component of w parametrizing each of the extra dimensions, there's a corresponding n mode here, and you sum over all of them. And the nice thing about these things is that they are orthonormal eigenfunctions. So if I plug them into they're orthonormal with respect to second derivatives. If I take these and I plug them into the action for the graviton field, we get back the graviton field, except the KK modes pick up masses. And if I just find where I am, the KK modes decompose. For the zero mode, there's only a single mode. And here we had decomposing it into zero. We could decompose our HMN, zero mode graviton component, in terms of things that transform in different ways under the four dimensional Lorentz subgroup. So H mu nu is spin to massless graviton. This is what we identify with our usual gravity graviton. This is a vector that I get from taking, let's say, the first component to be a Lorentz index and the second component to being one of the extra dimensional indices. So these A indices run over the extra dimensions. And here is a Lorentz scalar in four dimensions that I get from setting both of these indices to the extra dimensional values. And if I count numbers of degrees of freedom, this has 2 degrees of freedom. Here I have n times the 2 degrees of freedom of a massless vector. And here for this SAB, it's symmetric. So I have n plus 1 over 2. And if you sum these all up, I get 1/2 n squared plus 5n plus 4, which is equal to d minus 3 over 2, which is the number of independent degrees of freedom of a two-index symmetric tensor, modulo the general coordinate invariance constraints I can apply. So this is at the zero mode, and all these states are massless. And then at a given non-zero n mode, I have states with mass mn, and let me just find my, and mn is going to be, if I get it right, 1 over r times n1 squared plus n2 squared. It'll just be the magnitude of the vector. which of course is just the square root of n1 squared plus n2 squared plus nn squared. So now this 1 over r tends to be fairly small on particle physics scales, so typically much, much less than a GeV. So these KK modes, or actually I have to write down what they are, but these KK modes are all very light. So the zero mode is massless. These KK modes are all very light and very closely spaced. And the actual modes of these, I get a 2-index massive guy. And in this case, this is massless, so I have 5 degrees of freedom. In this case, I would have I would have 3 for each massive vector. But now, because of the constraints that are related to general coordinate invariance, I subtract off a 1. So there's a condition that projects out some of the extra modes here. And for this guy, I would have 1 times n plus 1 over 2. But it ends up being n plus 1 over 2 minus n, again, because of the set of constraints I get. So these constraints that are kind of easier to see in the massless case, in this case, correspond to the fact that some of the scalars here are eaten to make massive vectors, and some of the vector modes are eaten to make a massive spin 2 particle. So if you count all these up, it turns out that at each level, you also get the same number of 1/2 n squared plus 5n plus 4, which is your d minus 3 over 2. And one last thing, I want to write before moving on from this story, or at least talking about some of its consequences, is that these are the graviton modes. And what we're really interested at the end of the day is how these various modes, both the zero mode and the higher modes, couple to the standard model matter. Because we're the standard model, and that's how we measure gravity. And that's how we would measure the extra stuff, too. So first of all, it turns out, I won't go through this all, but h mu nu 0 and h u nu n, these couple to the standard model energy momentum tensor with the usual 1 over m Planck. It turns out, though, that these other modes, a lot of these other modes end up decoupling, in the sense that a lot of these other modes, even though they're in the spectrum, don't actually couple to anything. And because they don't actually couple to anything, or at least nothing in the standard model, we can essentially ignore them. So as far as these go, at level n, usually you define something called the dilaton. And the dilaton turns out to be the sum on A of this S of n AA. So in other words, here I have lots of different AB components. So I have a lot of different scalars. But the linear combination of the scalars such that I set A equals to B and I sum over A's, this is what I call my dilaton. And this thing couples to the trace of the energy momentum tensor, or the trace of the standard model part of the energy momentum tensor with strength 1 over m Planck. And all the other stuff just doesn't couple to the standard model. And since the other stuff doesn't couple to the standard model, and only potentially couples to other stuff in these gravity multiplets gravitationally, we typically just ignore them. So the physical things we go out and look for The parts of the spectrum we go and look for are these dilaton, or sometimes they're called radion modes, and the KK modes of the graviton. The zero mode is just what we identify with the usual graviton we'd have in four dimensions. Now, one issue besides the massive KK modes is there's also a massless dilaton mode at the zero level. And that massless zero mode at the dilaton level would be a problem because it would mediate a long-range force. And what you can show it corresponds to is, in a sense, the masslessness of that state corresponds to the fact that we don't have anything stabilizing the size of these extra dimensions. And in a more complete theory, so let's say we try to embed this in a theory where instead of just imposing a background geometry, we put in stuff on top of the standard model in gravity such that this geometry was stabilized. Without extra stuff, this geometry just turns out to be unstable and tends to contract on itself. And that contraction instability corresponds to this massless scalar. So the idea is that we know in principle we have to put stuff in to stabilize this. We don't necessarily know what that stuff is, but for the time being, let's just assume that it makes this would-be massless dilaton heavy, and let's drop it. So at this point, this is a bit of a cheat. But this kind of stabilization issue actually comes up when you try to build extra dimensions in string theories. We try to stabilize everything such that you get a self-consistent GR solution, such that your background geometry is stable. And this issue is sometimes called a dilaton or moduli stabilization, and it's one of the big open questions in string theory, how to stabilize all the moduli in your theory. In any case, we're going to brush those issues under the rug and just treat this as some effective background and just ignore the would-be zero-mode dilaton. Now, going back, we have the KK-mode dilatons and the graviton KK modes. And these can potentially do interesting things. So you can constrain this idea in three ways. So the first way is deviations from 1 over r squared gravity. So for regular gravity, you can think of it as, let's say I have some standard model matter. So I'll just draw it, let's say, as a standard model fermion. It could be something else. And our picture of gravity at the level of our quantum effective theory at low energies is just standard model matter, standard model of matter scattering off each other by exchanging these massless gravitons. And you put this all together, you contract up all the tensor things, and this gives you your 1 over r squared force law with strength equals like 1 over m Planck squared. But what can also come into the scattering in our KK theory is exchange of these KK modes. And depending on what the momentum transfer is in the scattering, which corresponds to roughly 1 over the energy transfer in the scattering, you can relate this to 1 over r, where r is a distance that you're measuring the relative force. If I start measuring the force between, let's say, two point masses at very short distances, this is, if you like, morally equivalent to scattering standard model particles at higher and higher energies. And if I get to high enough energies, corresponding to short enough distances, I'm going to start to have relevant exchange of these KK modes. So as far as the KK modes go, you can parameterize their effect this way. So the leading correction from KK mode correction is that. And in this particular theory, you expect alpha to be about 1 and lambda to be roughly over 1 over the first KK mass, which turns out to be roughly the radius of your extra dimension. So this picture matches up with the hand wavy picture I gave to you yesterday, where if you start measuring the interaction between point masses gravitationally, a distance is smaller than the radius of the extra dimension, the exchange of these higher KK modes becomes important. And now gravity is effectively leaking into all the dimensions. And instead of having a 1 over r squared law, you start to deviate towards something like 1 over r to the n plus 2. Now, as you're transitioning from 1 over r squared to 1 over r to the n plus 2, this is what it looks like in the transition region. So because we're going from somewhere that's solidly 1 over r squared and we're looking for deviations, this is a useful parameterization of those effects. So people have gone off and done very, very clever and very precise measurements of this, where these various torsion balances and it's a bit of a headache taking your experiment and shielding it from backgrounds, such that you can actually isolate the gravitational piece. But the upshot of all this is that this R is not constrained to be less than about 37 microns, which corresponds to, if we're fixing the hierarchy problem, n greater than or equal to 3. So we need at least 3 extra dimensions such that the KK mode mass is large enough that we don't mess up the 1 over r squared law. So the second place, the second kind of constraints on the story are from precision and collider measurements. Okay, and one challenge for this theory is that the theory is now non-renormalizable, and the energy cutoff for the non-renormalizability is roughly m star. So in general, we expect So for example, a really dangerous one would be 1 over m star squared QQQL. And the challenge is that at m star, we're actually hitting quantum gravity. And we don't really have any much, at least at this level, we don't have much control over quantum gravity. We don't necessarily know what it's going to give. But if we just write down the most general thing consistent with the gauge symmetries of the theory, I can have stuff that breaks symmetries like B minus L, or B plus L, which this one breaks. And this would be a problem because, as you saw earlier, this can induce proton decay at a dangerous level for M star less than about 10 to the 16 GeV. Whereas we know that we want M star to be more like a TeV to solve the hierarchy problem. So this kind of constraint is a big puzzle for this kind of theory. But you can imagine adding extra symmetries to the theory to get rid of this kind of operator. But even at a more prosaic level, I can have other operators of a similar form, just, let's say, f bar gamma mu f bar prime gamma mu f. These are standard model fermions. And these kinds of operators can So operators like this. So suppose I put in electron, electron, muon, muon. This can give you deviations in the energy dependence relative to what you get in the standard model to, let's say, E plus E minus to mu plus mu minus. And this, and these operators can also correct things like the effect of weak force at the loop level. And the upshot of this is these things often force M star to be greater than about a TeV. So this kind of constraint is kind of in the ballpark. It's pushing us up beyond where we'd like to be, but still not insanely large. So this kind of thing isn't so bad. Another place you could look for this kind of scenario is in particle colliders. So one nice feature is, as long as we don't have to worry about these let's say baryon lepton number violating type operators, you can actually look for processes that would that would create KK gravitons. So for example, one of the operators I can get out from my effective 1 over m Planck h mu nu n t mu nu sm one of the contributions from the energy momentum tensor of the standard model gives you an operator that looks like two gluons coming in, photon going out, and an h mu nu going out. And this, for example, could give rise to direct KK mode production at the LHC or other high energy colliders. And typically, this KK gravitino would just leave the detector. You wouldn't see it. You would see the photon, though. And this signal would be so-called monophoton, in the sense that you see one photon from a collision and nothing else. And this is something that's pretty hard to fake with the standard model. So suppose we were to compute the cross-section for, let's say, glu-glu goes to gamma plus h mu nu n. Based on the size of this coupling, we know that the effect of coupling goes like 1 over m Planck. So this thing we expect to go like 1 over m Planck squared. And this is a really, really tiny cross-section that normally we'd have no hope of seeing in a particle collider. It's just way too small. But the thing is, this is the production cross-section for a single KK mode. But we know that we have lots of KK modes that are very closely spaced. So in principle, because any of the KK modes would contribute to the monophoton signal, we should sum up all the contributions to that signal. And I'm going to call this sigma sub n. And what we really want is sigma total, which is a sum on n of sigma n. And what you can do here is convert this, the sum over n, where the n's are very closely spaced, into an integral over a continuous variable, in much the same way you do when you look at, let's say, you count momentum modes in statistical mechanics. So if you remember back to statistical mechanics for an ideal gas, you have your various states are just different momentum modes of the free gas particle. And instead of summing up, and typically you start off with your gas in a box. In that case, your momentum modes are all quantized, assuming periodic boundary conditions. But to sum everything up, what you do is instead of summing over those quantized modes, you replace the discrete sum with an integral weighted by a phase space factor. So you can do the same thing here. And you can convert this into into something that goes like r to the n 1 over m Planck squared integral dm of m to n minus 1. So what I'm using here is the sum on n can go to an integral over sum on modes. And the sum on modes depends on the number of extra dimensions you have. So the more extra dimensions you have, the more modes you have to count over. And it turns out that this goes like a sum over the masses of all the final states of dm of r to the m minus 1. So okay, so I'll write this up more carefully. But the upshot at the end of the day is that your sigma total at the end ends up going like r to the n over m Planck squared times this sum over all the n's. And this sum goes from 0 all the way up to essentially the largest energy you can access. And your total cross-section ends up going like, one over m star to the m plus 2. If I combine m Planck and r in this way, I get m star using my top relation up to possibly some 2 pi factors. And this thing is going to give me something that goes like emax to the n just on dimensional grounds. So the thing you get at colliders is that your total cross-section, when you sum over all the modes, instead of being suppressed by powers of the Planck scale, you're now suppressed instead by powers of the fundamental gravitational scale, which in this case we're assuming is about a TeV, which means that this cross-section is some rapidly rising function of it's a rapidly rising function of the energy. So you can go and do these searches. And so far, we haven't seen any excesses in monophotons. And these translate into limits that depend on the number of extra dimensions of m star greater than about, you get something like 14 TeV for n equals 2. You get something like 1.5 TeV for n equals 3. And then you get lesser things for larger n. So you can do these collider searches. And lastly, okay, I'll just skip over this quickly because I want to move on. A third way you can constrain this picture is with astrophysics. And specifically, with astrophysics, you can look at various kinds of stars. And certain kinds of stars are not supported by any kind of nuclear burning. They're supported by degeneracy pressure. So what I mean by that is your normal star is, if you like, a ball of gas that has a balance between the gravitational pull that's trying to squeeze the gas all in together and the thermal pressure pushing out because you have nuclear reactions in the core that generate heat and balance things out. So a regular star is a balance between this thermal outward pressure and the gravitational inward attraction. But in some stars, if they're around long enough, they can run out of nuclear fuel. And at that point, they'll contract in, and they need some kind of pressure to stabilize them. And depending on how big they are, the first thing that's likely to stabilize you is a degeneracy pressure of electrons. And a star that's stabilized by the degeneracy pressure of electrons is called a white dwarf. And a white dwarf, if you like, starts off as a regular star that runs out of fuel and then contracts. And the story, what ends up happening there is the white dwarf, because it's run out of nuclear fuel, it starts off pretty hot, but it just cools down over time. And you can go look at your white dwarf, and you can see you can essentially measure its temperature from its color, and use that to estimate how quickly the white dwarf is cooling down. Now, the cooling of the white dwarf is a complicated process, but it doesn't actually happen all that fast, because stuff inside the white dwarf has trouble getting out. The stuff getting out is what you need to cool. On the other hand, if you can produce KK modes inside a white dwarf, the KK modes can escape from the white dwarf and make the white dwarf cool faster. So you can get constraints on new light things, like KK modes, from the cooling of white dwarfs. You can also do something similar from the cooling of neutron stars. So neutron stars are also a little bit like white dwarfs, but except here, instead of being stabilized by electron pressure, you're stabilized by neutron pressure. And finally, you can also look at supernova. And supernova have a similar cooling issue, and you can also constrain these KK modes with supernova. So the upshot of all this is that you can get pretty strong bounds on various numbers of n's that are kind of similar, maybe a bit stronger than this, from these stellar constraints. So there's a wide range of ways to constrain this large extra dimension story. It's not necessarily ruled out. It's something that people are looking for at the LHC. But there's still some puzzles. And one of the big puzzles is trying to get rid of these things like baryon and lepton number violating operators. But in principle, from a low energy perspective, it's just something we don't have anything educated to say about. OK, so this is a large extra dimensional picture, where we saw quite literally that the force of gravity was diluted by the volume of the extra dimensions. And we were able to push down the fundamental Planck scale to hopefully near the TeV scale. I want to change directions now and talk about a different way of, if you like, making gravity effectively weaker. And that's through localization in an extra dimension. So the name for this is typically warped extra dimensions, or sometimes also called Randall syndrome. And the setup here is a little bit different from the setup we have had over there. The setup here is actually pretty similar to what you looked at in your in the tutorial. And the idea here is that we just have some extra dimension of finite length. So here's a W coordinate. And for each value of W, you have a four-dimensional space. And for reasons that we'll see in a second, we're going to call the W equals 0 part the so-called UV brain. So this W equals 0 surface is just a fixed four-dimensional surface, an extra dimension. And we're going to call it a brain to match up with the stringy terminology. And the one at a larger W, a non-zero W, we're going to call the IR brain. OK. And it turns out that this geometry, as long as we assume that we can put a brain here and a brain here and fix them in place and give those brains tension, what happens in this bulk space in between is going to be, the geometry of the bulk space will be affected by the energy on the brains. And the geometry in the bulk space will also be affected by the effect of vacuum energy in this space. So if we assume that there's a brain tension here and here, and that there's a net effective cosmological constant in this five-dimensional space in between, it turns out that there is there's a consistent GR solution. And that consistent GR solution, when you put everything in, has the following form. So this is a nice solution in the sense that locally, at any fixed point in W, it's Minkowski flat. On the other hand, there's a net curvature. And the net curvature is described by this K parameter. And this kind of geometry, so in this case, you should think of this as just a toy model. But this kind of geometry can actually come out of certain stringy constructions where this W equals zero brain actually corresponds to multiple extra dimensions that are compactified on a very, very small radius manifold, if you like. And the direction going out here, if you like, is something sticking out of this very small outer manifold, or inner manifold, and ends up looking like kind of a horn coming out or some kind of protrusion. And so sometimes this geometry is called a warp throat. So the idea here is that you have, I'm not going to draw this very well, you have some complicated compact manifold, and then you have various. Okay, so I haven't drawn this very well, but the idea is that you have some compact inner space, and this inner space we're identifying with W equals zero, and there are certain regions, for one reason or other, that have these extended structures sticking out. So these are sometimes called warp throat. So this 5D picture, if you like, you can just think of it as a toy model for this kind of stringy geometry. Yep.
So the 5D picture has a space-time which is boundaries, right?
Yes.
Well, so
here the W coordinate. So this would be like W equals zero, and this is what we're calling W equals pi r. So, and well, and the other thing is within this higher dimensional space, at least here, there's some notion of one of the dimensions being stretched out. And within this higher dimensional space, you can have brains in various locations. So you can think of this as a brain localized at the end of the throat. Okay. In any case, here's our geometry. And here's our metric. And for now, we're not going to worry about where it actually comes from. We're just going to fix this metric and see what it implies for the effective theory of our standard model. So the first thing we want to check is the action for gravity. And the gravitational action is just the usual story. As it'll be m cubed integral d4x integral 0 to pi r dw g. And the five-dimensional Ricci scalar that you construct out of this metric. And if we take this metric, and we look at fluctuations around it exclusively in the 4D components. In other words, if we look at fluctuations of the form where we assume that our metric is fixed here, has zero off-diagonal components, but we allow a general g mu nu here, and expand around this g mu nu in graviton modes. We can also write, we're going to write g mu nu is e to the minus 2 kw a to mu nu plus h mu nu over m star to the, I think it's the 3 house power. If we expand our g mu nu this way, so the idea is we're allowing fluctuations in this part of the metric, but not in any other parts of the metric. So if we take this and we plug it in, you can show that a minus g r5 is equal to, let me move this up a bit. After some fiddling with all this stuff, you can show that this is given by minus g bar r bar e to the minus 2 kw, where g bar and r bar are stuff from where this thing is what I call g bar mu nu. So in other words, I'm factoring off the warping, the exponential piece, and the part where I factor off the warping piece, the part left over, I'm calling g bar. So you can show that this warping piece can factor out in the sense that my full root g r can be turned into a root little g r bar times the exponential thing. So if I take this, and I plug it in, And I assume that these fluctuations also only depend on x. If I take this and I plug it back in over here, what I find is that I get out 1/2 m star cubed over k, 1 minus e to the minus 2 pi kr integral d4x minus g bar r bar. So the point is that this is the usual Forty gravity, and I factored off essentially the dependence on the warping. And the dependence on the warping, if I match it up to the usual story, just means that this thing should be equal to m Planck squared over 2. And the upshot of all this is this now gives me my relation between our four-dimensional Planck scale, the one that we see at large distances, and the parameters of this warp geometry. So in other words, I get m Planck squared equal to m star cubed over k, 1 minus e to the minus 2 pi kr. And what I expect from this, naively, just based on dimensional analysis, is that this m star coincides with the fundamental scale of a quantum gravity in my extra dimensional theory. So this is the really fundamental scale of gravity. Just based on dimensional analysis, I would also expect most of my other dimensional quantities to be about that same size, unless they're protected by a symmetry. So that suggests that this k, this curvature, should also be set by roughly m star. So that means that m star and k should be similar, which means that both of these should be pretty similar to m Planck squared, as long as this kr, this 2 pi kr, is, let's say, larger than order 1. So we're going to assume that kr is slightly larger than 1, so this piece is totally negligible, and that m star and k and m Planck are all about the same size. So here we don't actually have a volume dilution, but we are going to see that there's a sense in which localization is going to make the effective strength of gravity small. But our first step is to identify the fundamental parameters with what we call the Planck scale in four dimensions. Okay. So this is our initial picture. Now suppose we take this geometry and suppose we localize the Higgs to the IR brain. So in other words, we assume that the Higgs is forced to live at W equals pi R. Now, the action for the Higgs, taking this into account, is going to be just the usual thing you write down, d4x integral dw minus root g. And the kinetic term for the Higgs is now g mu nu del mu h del nu h. And then you subtract off a potential that depends on the Higgs. And I put in a delta function to enforce that the Higgs has to live on the IR brain. So this is the action for something that just looks like a regular 4D Higgs. We're assuming the Higgs only lives on that four-dimensional subspace. So if I take a W derivative with respect to it, I get zero. So there's no extra dimensional dependence on the Higgs. So I only keep the mu nu components of the metric here. And this delta function, again, is enforcing the localization. So I can take this, and I can cancel off the integral. Well, I can get rid of the integral with the delta function. And that means that I should evaluate also the W dependence in the metric at W equals pi R. So when I do this, I get a d4x. So recall that this g is a determinant when I say G, what I mean is you take the metric, you take its determinant, and then take the square root. And what you get out of this is e to the minus 2kw. And if I take the determinant, I get an e to the minus 2kw for each of the four each of the four Lorentz components. And then I just got one for the other thing, or minus one for the other thing. So when I put this all together, I just get four powers of this. But then I have to divide by two powers for the square root. So this root g gives me this. And this g mu nu evaluated at w equals pi r. Oh, sorry. And I should evaluate this at w equals pi r. I have 2 pi kr here. This g mu nu is going to be eta mu nu times e to the plus 2 kr. E to the plus 2 pi kr. And I get plus 2 kr here because it's the inverse metric. So yeah, so be careful that now that the metric and the inverse metric are no longer the same thing. So I put this all together, and what I get out of it, well, what I see is that I have some scaling factor that's multiplying the kinetic term. And if I count the number of powers, here I get plus 2. This is going to give me minus 4 at the end of the day. So this first kinetic term is going to have a prefactor that goes like e to the minus 2 pi kr. And if you recall in field theory, the thing you always want to start with is canonically normalized kinetic terms. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to canonically normalize them. And to canonically normalize them, we make a change of variable. We're going to write h as e to the pi kr of h tilde. And if I do this change of variables and rewrite my action in terms of h tilde, I just get d4x. As far as this goes, when I turn h into h tilde, the e to the pi kr factors cancel out over here. And I'm just left with the usual del h thing. But now my potential, first of all, is now going to be given by, instead of being a function of h, it's going to be a function of e to the pi kr h tilde. And in this v term, because I don't have this extra e to the plus 2 kr here, I'm still going to be stuck with an e to the minus 4 pi kr. So the point is my initial potential gets rescaled by this factor at the end of the day. And that's the cost of making my kinetic term canonically normalized. OK, so my kinetic term looks good, but let's worry about the potential. For the potential term, let's assume that I start off with the usual vanilla Higgs potential of minus mu squared h squared plus lambda over 2 h to the fourth. So in this full theory, the natural value of mu squared, if you take into account quantum corrections and the fact that we have a specific dimensionful scale of m star, the natural value of mu squared is roughly m star squared. But we want to make an effective value that's much lower, and this is the usual hierarchy problem. What happens in this case, though, is that because of the geometry, we're forced to do a rescaling. So what we really want is v to the h tilde, e to the minus 4 pi kr. Sorry, it's not v to h tilde. It's v to the e to the pi kr times h tilde e to the minus 4 pi kr. So if I take this and plug in this, what I find is I get minus mu squared e to the minus 2 pi kr times h tilde squared plus lambda over 2 h tilde of the fourth. So all I've done is, even though I started off with these variables, These are natural variables to use in the 5D theory. And in the 5D theory, I start with just the usual kinetic term. When I rescale and go into this effective theory on the IR brain, I have to do rescaling of the kinetic term. This feeds through to a rescaling of the fields here. And I'm left with this thing. So I can rewrite this as minus mu e to the minus pi kr squared h tilde squared plus lambda over 2 h tilde the fourth. So this thing is, if you like, the magic. Okay, I shouldn't call it magic, but you get the idea. This thing is a very nice result. And this is a very nice result in the sense that suppose we expect naturally that mu is on the order of m star. What we want, though, is an effective mu that's near the weak scale. So even if this is true, we have that our effective mu is given by mu e to the minus pi kr. And this effective mu is on the order of the TeV for kr, it turns out to be of about 11. So having this product k and r, r, if you recall, is the size of the extra dimension, and k is the curvature in the bulk. Having k and r be related by something that's not too far from 1 is totally fine. It's essentially completely natural. And in this sense, this warp geometry gives you a solution to the hierarchy problem, provided that Higgs lives on the IR brain. In that, because of the exponential, we call it a warping, all the mass terms of any mass parameter of something that lives on the IR brain gets warped down, gets rescaled by the exponential. And as long as we have a modest hierarchy in the exponential, order 1, we're able to take our would-be large fundamental scale parameters and warp them down to something that's more like a TV scale. So this is why we call the pi r, the pi r boundary the IR brain, because it's taking the stuff with a very large fundamental scale, and if you like, because of the localization, pushing it down to a much lower effective scale. So this is a nice thing about these so-called warped or Randall syndrome scenarios, that the geometry essentially fixes up the dimensionful parameters for you. Now, let me just this will be a bit of foreshadowing, but let me just also remind you that this exponential relation was also the reason why we were able to get small dimensionful scales in strongly coupled theories. So remember that we had, for example, lambda QCD. We were able to write lambda QCD as some input scale times e to the minus 2 pi divided by alpha s of the input value times the beta function coefficient. And what we have here is mu effective equals mu naught e to the minus pi kr. So we're going to see that there seems to be a connection between this idea of getting a strong coupling scale that's fairly low, even if I start with a very large input scale. So for example, I could start with the Planck scale. And if I start with the Planck scale and an alpha s that's sort of moderately small, not tiny, but let's say like 0.5 or something, through this, in this case, through the renormalization group effects, I get an exponential here. And that makes my fundamental scale some exponentiated, something that's exponentially small compared to the input scale. We're finding something very similar here. And we're going to push this analogy a bit further tomorrow. The first thing I want to do, though, before I get to that, and just to finish up this course, or to finish up this class, is say a little bit about KK modes in the warp background. So let me just make sure I have all my sheets. Okay, so to set up what I want to do tomorrow, to finish off talking about RS theories, or warp theories, is a change of variables. And this change of variables is going to make the calculations a bit easier and connect here as well. Okay, actually, I'll just go over here. Okay, so the so-called RS1 theory. Puts all the standard model on the IR brain. And that means that the only explicit thing going on in the fifth dimension, we call it the bulk space. The only thing going on in the fifth dimension in RS1 is essentially gravity. So if you put gravity, so gravity in RS1, if you do a KK expansion, you'll get KK modes for the graviton. And we'll get to that tomorrow. But more general, RS theories also puts gauge and fermions in the bulk. So for doing both of these, a change of variables is useful. And this change of variables is going to be essentially e to the minus kw is equal to one over kz. So here I'm defining a new variable z, or equivalently, w is equal to k inverse log kz, and dw is 1 over kz. And the range for z, we're going to call the range of z L1, L0 to L1. So L0 corresponds to w equals to 0, which means z is k inverse. And L1 is going to be k inverse e to the pi, e to pi kr. So z is going to start off from something that's pretty small to something that's much, much bigger. And the reason for this change of coordinates is that with this change of coordinates, we have ds squared is going to be L naught over z squared eta mu nu dx mu dx nu minus dz squared. So okay, actually, just a quick comment. This z is not the phi plus 1 z. It's some separate fifth dimension coordinate. So it's an abusive notation, but it's a standard one, so my apologies. So this is now our metric. And the nice part about this is that it's said to be conformally flat, in that the form of the metric for this change of variables is now something that's flat times an overall scale factor that depends on z. So this is sometimes called conformally flat. And just for reference, this means that GMN can be written as L0 over z squared eta MN. And the inverse metric, obviously, is just z over L naught squared eta MN. So in terms of this change of variables, it turns out that this form is often easier to work with, and it's the one I'm going to stick with. And okay, I'm just about out of time, so just a quick preview. We're going to start off by looking at gravitons or gauge bosons in the bulk, and we'll see that the KK mode solutions, previously we had exponentials, or equivalently sines and cosines. What's going to happen in this case is we're going to find that the KK mode, the proper KK mode functions, wave functions are going to correspond to Bessel functions. And if you recall Bessel functions have some power law behavior as their argument goes to zero. But at larger values of the argument, they end up being oscillatory with a slight damping. So we'll get to that tomorrow. But just as a setup, keep this metric in mind. And I guess I'll see you in a bit.